What is the scale of US economic engagement in China? And what is the impact of the Trump-era hostilities on the business sector? What are the key areas of American economic interests in the country? How competitive and innovative is China now? And what are the biggest systemic barriers for American businesses in China? Is it easy to succeed in the country for big businesses and SMEs from the US? How should the Biden administration work with China and with the EU? We will pose these questions to Ambassador Craig Allen, the 6th president of the US-China Business Council, a non-profit organization representing over 200 American companies doing business with China. I'm Marcin Jakobi, and I will be co-hosting this meeting with my partner, Mr. Zbigniew Niesiobęcki from the Polish-Chinese Business Council. You're listening to China Talk, a series of meetings produced jointly by the management zone of the SWPS University Poland and the Polish-Chinese Business Council. We ask leading global experts on China and East Asia on the latest developments and trends in Chinese economy. We discuss the political and social factors influencing business dealings and analyze the current state of economic relations between China, Europe, and the US. To discover more, please visit our multimedia channels on YouTube and Spotify. Welcome to another meeting in our China Talk series. And our guest today is Mr. Craig Allen, president of the US-China Business Council. It's a very important non-profit and non-partisan organization representing over 200 American businesses that are doing business with China. Mr. Allen previously served as US ambassador to Brunei Darussalam, finishing his post less than 3 years ago. And before that, he worked in Washington, D.C., worked at the International Trade Administration, and was previously to that Deputy Assistant Secretary for Asia. And he has had a very, very rich and interesting diplomatic career, serving in South Africa, Beijing, Tokyo, Taipei. And most of his duties were connected with the area of commerce. He was commercial officer. And Craig Allen is a graduate of Georgetown University and University of Michigan. Craig, it's our great pleasure to have you here with us.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, and I look forward to the discussion.
Great. Thank you very much. Zbigniew, over to you for the first question.
Maybe first, I want to thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for accepting our invitation. It's a great honor to host you in our China Talk series. And I would also like to add that our two organizations are counterparts, and I hope we will work closely together in the new build transatlantic relationships. So at the beginning, I would like to start with the scale of involvement of US companies in China. How important is the Chinese market to American business?
So the US and China are the two largest economies in the world, and we are very closely integrated in so many ways, trade, travel, investment. On the trade side, we have an enormous relationship, about $600 billion a year. Now, the relationship is quite unbalanced, with a very large trade surplus for China and a very large trade deficit for the United States. American companies have been investing in China for 40 years, and we have a very significant installed base or a foundation for investment in China. All of my members are major investors in China, some of whom have $10 billion or more invested in that market. Many have been very, very successful in that market. So we have a complex, multidimensional relationship between the two countries that is really extremely dynamic and changing every day. I would say that looking at the near-term future, we see a great expansion of service trade and trade in data, and that is over the internet. In addition to that, we see a pretty smooth trade across all consumer goods and services. While there are additional tariffs on going both ways across the Pacific, the trade between the two sides has not slowed dramatically, and in some cases has picked up. So this relationship is enormous. It is extremely complex. We have a very large amount of investment in China, and the Chinese have a large amount of investment in the United States. I should say that one other area where we see very great dynamism and growth is in the financial sector. There are probably 270 Chinese companies that are listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And Americans have invested probably $1 trillion in those companies. And similarly, there's a great deal of interest by Wall Street and other American savers to invest in China. As you know, the Chinese capital markets are opening. So we see a flood of interest going both ways. Venture capital, private equity, investment banking, regular banking services, pensions, and all types of new financial services or fintech. So this is an extremely large and dynamic and complex relationship that changes really on a day-by-day basis. Yes, we have been set back by COVID-19, of course, but I think that the relationship is certainly set to expand. And at the same time, in a very interesting way, both more competitive and as well as more cooperative, both at the same time. The famous American sinologist said, if you study China, you should enjoy a good contradiction or a good paradox. And there are many paradoxes in U.S.-China relations for us all to enjoy.
Yeah, I was thinking about one of them, you know, the very difficult tension, political tension between U.S. and China during the Trump administration era theoretically would affect the scope of Chinese-U.S. economic exchange. But if we see the statistics, actually, American investments, for example, in China have been growing. How do you explain this very tense political situation and the paradox of having very thriving economic relations?
So I think that the Trump administration started out with an economic assumption that ultimately is false. And that assumption is that bilateral trade deficits are caused by unfairness of the other guy. And we know that that's not true, and that rather bilateral trade deficits themselves are not relevant. Multilateral trade deficits are caused by an imbalance in savings, consumption, and investment. And in China, there's an imbalance there, too many savings. And in America, there's an imbalance, too little savings. And therefore, we have a large trade deficit. So the Trump administration put into place a set of tariffs to try to address that. It did not work. It failed. And it created a great deal of political unease at the same time. A lot of the Trump administration's political dynamism was based on an anti-foreign, anti-elite, anti-global, and anti-China assumptions, none of which were particularly accurate, but all of which were politically powerful. So the overall relationship has survived well, but there are many tensions. When we look at China, there are problems on every Chinese border. Most recently in Myanmar, but we could go around to China's 16 borders and find problems. And of course, the United States gets drawn in when there are problems that China has around its borders. And so this creates a geopolitical tension that continues to exist as well. So while the Trump administration had a very combative and confrontational attitude, at the same time, business was able to carry on reasonably well. And we will see where the Biden administration takes that. It is not yet clear. And it is the Chinese response to the Biden administration also is not yet clear. And so this is an important time to be having this discussion.
We know that there are over 100,000 U.S. companies operating now in China. We know that for many sectors, U.S. sectors, the Chinese market is crucial. For example, the U.S. chip makers as a sector have the highest revenue exposure to China. Such companies like Qualcomm, Micron Technology, or Broadcom earn more than 50% of the total revenue in China. You mentioned the biggest U.S. direct investment in China. You add that a lot of money is in the portfolio of the U.S. investment and pension funds. This is the very big scale of American involvement in China. So this figure show us how inadequate to the U.S. government strategy is business, U.S. business activity in China. Have the U.S. government decision, for example, on decoupling, have been consulted with U.S. businesses in recent years? That is any natural relationship, the consultation network between business and politics?
So it's a really interesting question. The word decoupling is an interesting word because we can define it very differently and talk about different things. I would say that the term is relevant in a few specific ways. One is supply chain. We want to be certain that in the case of a national emergency, that we will be able to supply the products that we need. And I think that COVID-19 was a real wake-up call there, that we don't want to be dependent on a single point of failure, particularly in China. We don't want to be dependent on a single point of failure anywhere, but particularly in China. So there is a lot of interest in not decoupling the supply chain, but expanding and making more flexible and pragmatic and network, rather than a supply chain, a supply network, such that if there is a single point of failure, that we're able to deal with that. A second area where decoupling is under a lot of discussion is on the technology side. And this becomes very complex. China's technology self-reliance and self-strengthening programs are a concern to the United States and to the EU and to Japan. It is my view that Made in China 2025 violated every chapter of the WTO. And I think that as we look forward to the upcoming political meetings in March and then in October of 2021, that there will be, if you will, a doubling down on what the Chinese call "科技自立自强," or technology self-reliance. What does technology self-reliance mean? What are the implications of that for the rest of the world? We will be looking towards China's policies on these issues very carefully and hopeful that those policies will be WTO consistent. Another area that is very important is data. And as you might have been familiar, the Trump administration tried to ban TikTok and WeChat. And the concern there is that Chinese corporate and potentially government entities have access to American citizens' private data. And if they have that, what are the implications of that? So there is a rather robust discussion going on both in Beijing and in Washington about data and how data might have national security implications. There is a danger in this discussion. There are privacy concerns about data that are very legitimate. There are economic concerns about data that are very legitimate. And there are national security concerns about data that are very legitimate. But they're not the same. And sometimes I think that there is a tendency to lump them together. Another area that has been a concern in the decoupling area has been, I would say, in research and development, science and technology, particularly affecting our university sector. And what we have seen there is, at the request of the demand of the government, considerable tightening of academic processes and procedures that would address some problems that have arisen in the past. We are concerned about the Thousand Talents campaign that seemed that is insufficiently transparent. And we want to be sure that if we have science and technology collaboration, that it is open, fair, transparent to everyone, and not being unfairly utilized by Chinese state enterprises. And that is a big concern that is ongoing. But it will not lead to decoupling. It will lead to more stringent processes and procedures and ethical regulations. I think that the final area of decoupling that we need to talk about is on the investment side. We welcome Chinese investment in the United States, but not all Chinese investment in the United States. There have been investments in high-tech firms that appear to be for the purpose of extracting technology and taking that to China, and that is not acceptable. And the Silicon Valley and the high-tech communities are required to screen this type of high-tech investment coming in to ensure that it is appropriate and helpful and commercial. If it is for normal trade and commerce, that's fine. But if there is a strategic element, then that is an issue. The Chinese side has a set of rules and regulations called civil-military fusion. And I think that as we study civil-military fusion, then we have more reservations about sharing of technology. And we wish to be careful about how we collaborate with our Chinese friends and colleagues to ensure that the technology is used in an appropriate manner and does not have a geostrategic or a military impact that is deleterious to the United States. And so as long as civil-military fusion exists as a policy in China, then I think decoupling in the tech space will remain a subject of interest. And I don't see how it could be otherwise.
Okay, if I might just squeeze in a question from the audience, there is Sylvia Kanya. Let me rephrase the question a little bit because it's about decoupling. In Europe, we have been talking a lot about this keyword, level playing field with China. Do you think that if American companies see that the playing field is not level at all, will this actually prompt them to be thinking more seriously about decoupling?
I think that the answer to that is yes, definitely. And the level, the playing field is not level at all in China. State-owned companies play the football down the hill. Private sector Chinese companies play up a little hill and foreign companies play up a mountain. And that is reality. I think that the Chinese government sometimes cares about that and sometimes they don't. In the consumer goods sector, for example, it probably doesn't matter so much. Even in industrials, it does not matter so much. In consumer services or travel, tourism, soft drinks, beer, it doesn't matter. Where it does matter is when you are competing against state-owned enterprises in China. When you look at the industries that are dominated by state-owned enterprises, it's a large percentage of GDP. We could talk about aviation, telecom, media, energy, mining, steel, automotive, nuclear, oil and gas, and we could go on and on. So my guess is it's about 40% of GDP, all of finance. If foreign companies are not allowed a level playing field in 40% of China's GDP, then that's a real problem. We have not received the WTO benefits that we thought we would when China entered the WTO. And it is my view, it's not my view, it's Xi Jinping's view, that state-owned enterprises should play a larger role in the Chinese economy. And I think that that raises fundamental questions about level playing field. And I think that we need to look at the structure of that and the role of the party along with the role of the regulator and the state-owned enterprises. And of course, in many cases, the party rank of the state-owned enterprise CEO is higher than the party rank of the regulator. And so this is ipso facto not a level playing field and something that is a valid concern by all of Chinese trading partners.
Maybe I return to the previous point about the trade and tech war. So the question is, who is the loser? Who is the winner of this US-China tech and trade war so far?
Well, I think it's useful to recall, I think it was in 1957 when Mao Zedong threw out all the Russians from China's technology program. And Mao Zedong said that no matter what, we will have our two bombs and a missile. And of course, 6 years later, they did. So there's a short term and a long term here. There's also very much a global element to particularly digital type of trade. So when I look at the decoupling thus far, it does look like a little bit like after a bar fight in a small town America, where two guys get into a fight and one breaks one guy's nose and the other one knocks out two teeth from the other one. Who won? Well, it's kind of a philosophical question. Their doctors did pretty well. Their lawyers probably as well. But both sides lose. I think on the technology side that we have a lot of respect for Chinese engineering scientific establishment. China has about 25% of the world's STEM workforce. It graduates 1.8 million STEM workers a year. They're very good. We want to work with Chinese tech companies, but we cannot. It's much more difficult to do that with civil military fusion. I think that the nature of technology has changed. In the Cold War, the military really developed most of the new technologies, and then they trickled down to the civilian technologies. Today, it's the opposite. And so there is a tendency to wish to control those new civilian technologies, even though today we don't see an immediate military use for them. AI, big data, 5G would be very good examples of that. This is going to be a very difficult dance into the future. And I think that we could summarize the question by asking, how do you define national security? And there are very different ways to do that. Personally, I would prefer a definition that includes managing differences diplomatically and coming to peaceful resolution of border disputes and things like that. But not everybody will agree with that. And others are preparing for the potential of conflict somewhere in the world. The United States has a vast network of treaty partners and alliances and military networks around the Pacific, and those are very important to us. And we want to ensure that we are able to maintain a technological strength, and that our alliance system is remains strong. And that is more and more difficult over time. And the issues, when looked at, not from a European perspective, this is European perspective and American perspective are very different here, is that the independence, autonomy of all of ASEAN countries, of Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, et cetera, are critically important to us. We have since for 100 years played the role of the anti-hegemon in Asia, and we wish to continue to that. To play that role and not allow any country to dominate the region. And we will take whatever means necessary to achieve that. In 1941, we went to war to achieve that. Our policy has been consistent for the last 100 years. It will remain consistent. We will maintain freedom of navigation, open seas, and an open system in Asia. And we will work with Asian countries that wish to maintain their own autonomy, independence, and culture in every way. And so this is a balance of power theater here that is complex, large, important, and ever evolving. The Chinese are playing the game quite differently. They're playing the game very well. And so we will continue to collaborate and compete with 1.4 billion Chinese on a day-by-day basis for the rest of our lifetimes.
Sorry, I think this is a perfect time to ask you another question from our viewers. And it's a difficult one, but as a diplomat, I'm sure you will forgive me for being so direct. The question is about what if in 10, 20 years, the innovation supremacy in the world will change in China's favor? How do Americans view such a possibility?
Oh, it's a wonderful question. I take great joy in that question. I think that the scale of the Chinese economy is super important for innovation. And when you are able to scale at 1.4 billion people, it is very likely that you are going to dominate a number of areas. My own view is that diversity is the key to innovation. And the thing that the Chinese companies lack is the diversity of everything to really be at the leading edge of innovation. And that where American companies excel is working with people from all over the world to build as diverse an environment as possible to innovate. So I think that there is a real possibility that China will dominate a lot of the innovative space in the future. The key problem, well, there are many problems, but a key problem that China faces is that its domestic university and laboratory system is quite corrupt. And there are all sorts of problems within that system. And I think that until those problems are addressed, it's very difficult for, say, a Polish or a French or Nigerian American company to work with them. They are not yet a fully integrated part of the global innovation ecosystem. And clearly, it's in everyone's interest to try and encourage them to live up to OECD standards for transparency, subsidies, state-owned enterprises, patent, intellectual property right, academic freedom, and we should work in that direction. We want an integrated global innovation ecosystem. And to the extent that we have to bifurcate that into an East and a West, we are all unfortunate, in my view. I have nothing but respect for Chinese innovation, and it is flowing fast and furious. I think that our friends in Silicon Valley need to watch Shenzhen very carefully, because if they don't, then their lunch will be missing and their future is dim. So how do we work with the Chinese to improve the innovation ecosystem in China And how do we integrate that so that everyone benefits? And this is an area that I think that the U.S. and the EU could really have a very productive conversation. And I hope that in the near term, and I expect that in the near term, we will be talking about this a lot more, because together we have the diversity, we have the talent, and we have an open system with which everyone wants to work. And I think that with gentle encouragement, we can help the Chinese to make their system more compatible with positive global common good. Rather than where we are right now, which seems to be a little bit predatory and excessively characterized by abuse and fraud.
We can look at this U.S.-China relationships from micro perspective and from micro companies perspective. The U.S.-China Business Council represent leading big U.S. companies, but do you know how the U.S. SME sector is doing in China? I ask about SME sector because in our economy, in Polish economies, SME sector is dominated. So we are very interesting in the experience the other companies like U.S. SME sector. So once again, the question, how the U.S. SME sector is doing in China?
I think it's very difficult for American SMEs to be successful in China on a predictable, in a predictable manner. So currently, because of Donald Trump's trade war, we have 19% tariffs in addition to WTO tariffs on American products entering into China. That almost makes it impossible for small and medium-sized enterprises to do business in China. And I think that the Biden administration is looking at that, but certainly has not committed to removing those tariffs. The exception where we have had some success on the SME side is through e-commerce. Many American companies have been able to sell ones or twos or threes or fours of a small lot exports to China through e-commerce. But it's difficult to build a business with this. And it's very hard to control your market in China because you don't know who you're selling to. And you don't understand the market, and it's impossible to travel. And so I would say that this is, unfortunately, a very difficult business for small and medium-sized enterprises to be engaged. I was talking to a very successful small, medium-sized enterprise president recently. And he said, I can run my business or I can negotiate with the Chinese, but I can't do both. And I understand that. China's hard. And one must be very cautious about intellectual property rights and understanding what is happening in the market in China. And if you don't have the intelligence to understand what's happening with your product, how it's being used, how it's being sold, what are the margins, what are the distribution channels, what is the after-sale use, what is the reputation, what does the social media say about it, then it's probably not sustainable. So this is a really hard place. And I never want to encourage a small, medium-sized enterprise to enter China if it's not going to help them. You know, like the Hippocratic Oath, you know, one should do no harm. And I worry about small, medium-sized enterprises that one can do harm, real harm. And one should be modest and careful about that always. So I wish Polish small and medium-sized enterprises every success. Please be careful.
Thank you very much. You as a council, for many years, you have been conducting a sentiment survey of U.S. companies operating in China. On this basis, you create a list of the most important challenges that companies face while doing business in China. So you mentioned some of this position on this list, but my question is whether there have been any significant changes on the list in recent past, or have new problems appeared, have some faded out, or have some become more important?
Thank you for that question. So the list has changed. And under the Trump administration, really political risk rose to number one. And that is the inability to control for government actions has become the number one source of concern for American companies in China. Another increasing risk is visas. Can we get a visa? And if can we send out engineers or workers to our programs? That's becoming much, much more difficult. A third area is absolutely common across all businesses is data. Are we able to put into place electronic systems that are compatible with the company's global system without breaking the law either in China or in the US? And that has become a much bigger concern. Yet another concern is that Chinese private sector companies are extremely competitive, and working against them, competing against them, it has become more and more difficult over time. They are fast, they are nimble, they are creative. The marketing environment using social media is extremely dynamic and innovative, and not as well known to us as it is to them. Government procurement and arbitrary government action remains a problem, but I would say that it's a steady state problem. There are concerns about the formation of Communist Party offices within American companies, but generally the role of those offices has been to take care of funerals and sporting events and talent shows. So it generally has not been a problem. Where we have seen improvement is certainly intellectual property rights are better respected, and American companies are generally able to go to Chinese court and get their property rights respected. I think that in other areas of regulation, that it's a mix. Corruption is down, so that's a wonderful thing. But government interference and arbitrary government action that we can't really understand or do anything about is on the increase. And that's the type of thing that one cannot take to court, but rather one must negotiate. And so for all American companies, knowing the local mayor at the city level, knowing the governor at the provincial level, and knowing the ministry at the national level is very important to try to manage disputes. Labor is becoming quite scarce and very expensive in China, depending on the type of labor. And the ability of the senior engineers or others to leave and start their own company remains. And so that type of trade secret loss is always a bit of a danger and something that needs to be managed. Now, coincidentally, our sister organization, the Chinese Business Association in the United States, has a very similar list of concerns that we have in China, including visas, including national security controls, including investigations. So there's a symmetry between American companies in China and Chinese companies in America that I think is quite interesting.
Just to sum this up, I have a short question from our viewers, from Janek Czekaj. If you were to just choose one biggest challenge in establishing fair US-China trade relations among the things that you already discussed, what would that be?
Technology. Technology is the problem. And the development of innovation is the key problem. And let me put it in the form of three questions. And if anyone on this podcast can answer these questions, I will give them $1,000.
Wow. Okay, let's listen attentively.
What are the rules of the road for cooperation on technology? What are the rules of the road for competition on technology? And because those two are so easy, how do you enforce those rules?
Okay, the $1,000 stays with you, I guess.
But I think that those are the critical questions that must be addressed as we look at China's integration in the global economy, Europe and America's role in the global economy, and how do we maximize this system so that we all continue to benefit and are not threatened? And it has to do with technology. And there are no easy answers here. But I think that that is the area where the United States and Europe need to sit down. Brussels recently sent a proposal for a US-EU Trade and Technology Council. And I think that this is quite interesting. And I would certainly wish to support such an idea as a way to increase our own cooperation between the US and EU, which is a good in and of itself. But in addition to that, as a way to encourage our Chinese friends to work at a higher standard and to integrate in a manner that is sustainable over time, that provides everyone advantage. We're not there because we don't have the rules of the road, and we need to develop those rules of the road. And until we have that, we are in an unstable situation.
So we return to this point, but I want to ask you about, despite the challenges which you mentioned, recent studies show that only 13% of American companies plan to leave China.
Yeah.
These results confirm the positive assessment of China's business outlook by U.S. firms and China's positioning as the top priorities for the company's global strategy. But in the pandemic time, the global supply chain's problem has been intensively discussed, especially when it comes to the China's position. Do you think China will remain the center of global supply chains, or will the companies realize the In China for China strategy and all the rest will be moved to the new locations? Can we expect any significant reconfiguration in this area, in your opinion?
Yeah, so this is a wonderful question, and we've done some research in this. And I think that our research shows a few things. Number one, China will continue to produce 30% of global growth for the next 10 years, approximately. And because of that, nobody's leaving China. We want to be in China for China. But as you said, there are supply chain shock concerns and a need to diversify outside of China. So even though China has wonderful manufacturing base, there is a more rapid migration out of China. Let me give you an example that I think is kind of interesting. In America, we love Christmas, and we love to have Christmas lights. And all of those lights had come from China 3 or 4 years ago. But now all of those lights come from Cambodia. Interesting. Now, are they made by Chinese companies in Cambodia? Are they shipped from China through Cambodia? Are they packaged and assembled in Cambodia? I have no idea. But I think it's an interesting case study. Now, according to our numbers, if for labor-intensive manufacturing, if one were to move the labor-intensive part of manufacturing anything, to ASEAN countries, you would receive about a 24% price advantage. If you move to the U.S.-Mexico border, to what we call Maquiladora, you would receive about a 26% price advantage. And so the economics are driving out a lot of low-level, labor-intensive manufacturing out of China, and that's a good thing. So it's a natural thing. As remember, China's labor pool is shrinking and will continue to shrink. While the infrastructure is very good, it is also developing in ASEAN, Maquiladora, in Eastern and Central Europe, too. So my hope is that we will be able to stay in China for China and also be able to expand investment in Central Eastern Europe, Latin America, and in ASEAN countries so that we're able to do more, particularly on the labor-intensive side, in the cheaper labor countries. So this is very dynamic, but the economics are clear, in my view, that China is no longer appropriate for labor-intensive manufacturing. It's no longer economic for labor-intensive manufacturing. And that is something that I hope will benefit many other countries. I assume Poland is at the much higher end there, but there are Central European countries that and Eastern European countries that I hope will benefit from outbound Chinese manufacturing investment or other investment, not necessarily Chinese, that will lead to a more diverse industrial base. So it's game on with a price advantage for Latin America and ASEAN, but still with China producing 30% of global growth, nobody's going to leave. But more and more manufacturing should be done outside of China and sent in. I think that RCEP is very interesting in this context. And if I were a Filipino or Indonesian or Myanmar, I would be very aggressively pursuing that type of investment. Still, it's very hard. Easier for shoes or textiles or apparel or cell phones and computers and tech. China has such a strong industrial infrastructure and engineering base that it's going to take a while. So let's focus on the more labor-intensive elements there or capital-intensive. I think that there's great success. In the tech-intensive, much more difficult to do so.
Well, let's shift to the last point of our discussion. I have the question because President Biden is introducing a reset strategy in many areas of U.S. foreign strategy. In relation to China, however, the existing instrument of pressure will probably be maintained at least for some time, but the changes to involve close cooperation with allies and the change in the style of cooperation. What else might change in this relationship? What are U.S. CBC recommendations to President Biden's administration with regard to China?
Let me look at that as a two-part. The first part is what is the administration is doing? And I think that in a foreign affairs article conveniently published right before the election, Jake Sullivan, who is our national security advisor, and Kurt Campbell, our Asia czar, published an article where they said exactly what they're doing right now. And that is they're leading with competition and that they will follow with cooperation. And I think that that is wise. We have to set firm red lines, guidelines on important strategic issues that we are going to be and try and freeze them into place, put them into place and hope that the Chinese side realizes that we're not going to be able to compromise on some things. Human rights would be one. Taiwan is a very difficult and important issue. South China Sea, we cannot compromise there. We can work, we can cooperate, but we cannot compromise on freedom of navigation. And there are several other issues. So that's being done right now. And then we will fold in the cooperation. And I think on cooperation, climate change has got to be number one, two, and three. My understanding is that the White House will have a climate change summit, a virtual summit in April, and we're hopeful that the Chinese will participate in that. And I think on COVID, there is a lot of potential room for collaboration. The USCBC is advocating that we maintain our phase one agreement, which President Trump and Xi Jinping agreed to almost exactly a year ago, February 15th, it went into effect. And we believe that it is a useful agreement and it should be fully implemented. It expires at the end of 2021. And we are hopeful that by that time, we will have been able to finish the discussions on the remaining issues, state-owned enterprises, subsidies, technology policy, and cyber policy. It's not complete them. It's not resolve them, but to make progress on them. And at that point, by the end of 2021, to remove all of the tariffs. After that, both China, Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang have both said that China wishes to join the CPTPP. And we take that very seriously. The United States, as you know, was a founding member of the CPTPP and withdrew. And there is some interest in taking another look at that. And so I think that agreement, which I worked on for many years, is an excellent structure, architecture, a blueprint for future negotiations. And I expect that we will congeal around that. I would prefer WTO-oriented discussion, but I think that might be overly optimistic. Let us wish our new WTO Director General all the luck in the world. But I think that it is excessively difficult to put U.S.-China competition and cooperation, particularly on technology, within the WTO context. It is possible to discuss that within the TPP context, and I hope that we go there. And that is something that we should explore with our European friends and colleagues, because CPTPP does offer technology standards that you might find useful. And if so, we should maybe work in a common direction.
Since you've been talking about this, and we have run out of time, I have one last question from our viewers, which is exactly on this. Stanisław Szufrajda asks us about your take on the comprehensive agreement on investment. If you could just tell us very, very briefly the American perspective, your personal perspective. We will be talking about this in a month's time with another guest from Europe, Professor François Godemont, but it would be great to have the American perspective.
Well, I am a big fan of François, so I think the world of him. I think that the CAI moved the ball forward, but not very little. So I think that it was a very good effort, but that the results of that effort are modest. And I would be particularly note that, well, we don't have all of the language yet. The market access annex has not been published, and I believe it's still being negotiated. So that's a bit of an issue. But when I look at subsidies and state-owned enterprises, I see modest improvement, better than the WTO, not as good as TPP. When I look at the labor provisions and particularly how they affect Xinjiang, I wish that they were stronger. So I think that it is, as a political mechanism, I think it was a very successful. The Biden team is quite disappointed that we did not work together on this. We feel that if we do work together, we could get more and that we need more. Right. So that's a summary.
Maybe at the end, it's a good moment to mention the document prepared by Yale Law School, a U.S.-Europe-China roadmap for President Biden's first 100 days. In my opinion, it's a very important document, and I know that you supported the preparation of this document. Maybe at the end, your comment connected with this report, with this document.
So the report is an attempt to explore how the U.S. and EU can work together to face common challenges in China. We recognize that our European friends are better than we are at a number of these disciplines, and we wish to explore how we can work together. And I would say that it's not only technology, but it's focused around technology. That goes to 100 different areas that we believe that by collaborating, we can help to improve the environment in China and through a positive example to improve market access and make China a more sustainable, open, transparent, fair economy. So we're not doing this against China. We would like to do it so that it supports reform in China, modernization in China, to assist China to get out of the middle income trap and become a full member of the developed world economy, the OECD level. And we think that by working together, we will be much more effective. So this paper presents maybe 20 different ideas where we might be able to collaborate. And we've had a good response across Europe from this. And so I think trying to put together a couple of ideas and driving them through to implementation would be just fine. Not everything. Let's just start small and build some confidence and work together, build a culture of working together in positive appreciation of China's potential and with a will to make it work on a global basis.
Thank you, Craig, for being so positive. We certainly do wish the documents and the incentives much success. It's been great listening to your insight and the information. And I'm very happy that you found time to meet with us. Just to remind our viewers, our guest was Ambassador Craig Allen, the 6th president of the U.S.-China Business Council. So thank you very much, Craig, for your time.
Thank you. What a wonderful pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador.
Goodbye.